Hello and welcome to Motorsport Speak, the weekly motorsport podcast brought to you by the team behind Motorsport Week and Motorsport Monday. My name's Dan Lawrence, and as ever, to talk all things Formula One, I'm joined by Motorsport Week and Motorsport Monday editor Taylor Powling. Grand Prix racing returned to China for the first time in 5 years this weekend, and it was also the first sprint weekend of the year. But despite there being a sprinkle of new in 2024, the pecking order remained the same. Max Verstappen ruled the roost. So let's get into it and do some motorsport speak. But first, Taylor, how are you?
Hi, Dan. I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Yes, not too bad. It was an interesting Grand Prix weekend for a number of reasons, in my opinion. But what did you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit of a... The sprint sessions were good with the sprinkler rain in the qualifying session, which I'm sure we'll get onto, and the controversy with the Norris lap time being deleted, then reinstated. And the actual sprint, there was quite a lot of action, a few clashes, teammate on teammate action as well. The Grand Prix itself, a bit disappointing. I guess we had a few moments that made it stand out, which I'm sure we'll get on to. But yeah, very much same old in the world of Red Bull and Max Verstappen.
Yes, quite a sort of a damning domination, if we want to go for some literary speak. But yeah, if we get into the sprint format first sprint of the year, first of six, and had a little rejig, as it seems to do every year, the sprint format. So we had first practice on Friday morning, followed by qualifying for the sprint on Saturday afternoon, then a Saturday morning sprint race itself. And that allowed Parc Fermé to be reopened, so we had no issues of plank wear like we did in Austin last year. Grand Prix qualifying on Saturday afternoon, and then normal Grand Prix normality on the Sunday. But yeah, I think I agree with you. The sprint qualifying itself was fun, and that's because there was a sprinkle of rain which came in, which was obviously why we got the George Russell dropout in Q2, because the rain started just as he was going to launch a last-ditched attempt to get into the top 10. And then the rain came down properly for the third qualifying session and it helped jumble up the order a little bit. We saw Alonso challenging for pole, or sprint pole, should I say. And then we had Lewis Hamilton punch his way to the top. And then Lando Norris was top, but then he wasn't. And then he was again. Obviously, he had his pole lap initially deleted for abusing track limits at the final corner on the run before the lap started. And then race control decided to reinstate it afterwards. What did you make of the deleting of the lap and then the reinstating of it?
I mean, the FIA kind of made their own problem in a sense, because if the lap had not been deleted in the first place, I don't think anyone would have complained. The fact is, at certain circuits, the race director's notes will include something where it says, if you go off on the final corner of your previous lap, the next one's invalidated. But that wasn't included here in Shanghai. Therefore, Norris's lap was fine. And if anything, it actually, as Andrea Silla pointed out, it cost him up to 0.3 anyway. He gained back all that time through the middle of final sector. And as we saw prior to him going off into the gravel, he was purple on that previous lap. So he had the speed. He didn't gain anything from it. If it had been a case of when we last went to Shanghai and there was no gravel at the final corner, it was just a tarmac runoff and you could, you know, gain something from Kermit because you could floor the throttle still, then yes, there's an argument that he might have gained an advantage. But there was gravel there, so he was already slow. It compromised the start of the next lap. And that wasn't the difference between him getting pole and not, because it was a 1.2-second margin. There should be no, I think people are complaining for the sake of complaining and acting like the rules are being changed on the fly. But in this case, yeah, there was nothing like that. It was perfectly legal.
Yeah, I mean, you say changing the rules on the fly, but I think sometimes there's you kind of need to a bit of nuance to see the wider context of the situation. Like you say, it was with the gravel trap. Like, you run through that rut of gravel, it will affect you. And then, as you say, he was 1.2 seconds clear of the rest of the field anyway, so regardless, it didn't matter. And as you say, the sake of complaining, I think people like to jump on board and complain about sort of FIA or race stewards or what have you for any instance. But you can't, I think, complain that, you know, the track limits situations like boring and because of all the tarmac runoff, and then complain when there's a gravel track bit in the runoff and the FIA look on that when they're making their decisions. But yeah, I think what was good, I think it's always good to have rain in a, yeah, penalties and reinstating laps aside, it's always good to have rain in a qualifying session because it helps jumble up the order and sort of puts in a bit of an unknown for the race. And also rain is, in motorsports, they always say it's the great equaliser. So which is why Hamilton managed to get the Mercedes into second and sort of, I guess, reminded everyone a bit of his abilities. And obviously Alonso, you know, Mr. Top 5 performer every weekend, he was able to get everything out of his package and do well in the wet. Max Verstappen didn't have as much fun in the wet, which is interesting because obviously he's a bit of a wet weather maestro himself. So he had to start sprinting fourth place. And yeah, I think people maybe thought with a sprint, obviously half race distance, you had that buffer of three cars in front of Verstappen. You had Norris at the front. Norris and Hamilton went toe-to-toe, lights out in the sprint. And Norris got hung out to dry on the outside of turn one. It was dirty offline and he basically sort of almost lost it and had to tumble down the order. And that was sort of all she wrote for Norris in the sprint. Things didn't go well for Norris. Hamilton and Alonso, they sort of had a little rehash of their battles of yesteryear, but that didn't last very long. Hamilton did the best at sort of eking out, you know, an advantage at the front for as long as he could. But Verstappen came like a freight train in the second half of the sprint. I think he passed Hamilton sort of at around half distance of the sprint and then romped away to a 13-second lead, which, yeah, I think there was there was interesting action in the sprint throughout Alonso's defence of the Ferraris and Sergio Perez including. But Verstappen's win was a sort of a foreboding warning for what would happen on Sunday, wasn't it?
Yeah, totally. Pulling a 13-second gap in 10 laps, as soon as that happened, you kind of knew that providing Verstappen's car didn't break down in qualifying and he was near the front of the grid, there was only going to be one winner. And yeah, just a different class. Perez potentially could have stopped that if he strung together his sprint qualifying. He had looked quick. He looked quicker than Max in the wet conditions, but a mistake on his final run meant he started two places behind Max and he was able to claw his way through to third, but couldn't quite get Hamilton, who, as you said, he did a really fine job. Kind of maximised that Mercedes package in the dry. It reverted back to its normal pace and he capitalised on circumstances more than anything to get second. The Alonso and Sainz incident, I see why they gave a penalty. I know whenever Alonso gets penalised, there likes to be a lot of discussion around that. And, you know, he likes to say the stewards are against him or whatnot. But when you actually look at a still image, which always doesn't always tell the case, but he died from a long way back. The Sainz has got the move down in turn 8 and then into turn 9. He died from a long way back, didn't hit the apex. Not only did it force Sainz wide, it also cost him a place to Perez. It let Perez pass them both. And I think Sainz picked up some minor damage at that point. He admitted that he had pushed his tyre quite hard in the early stages because Verstappen had been quite tentative at the start. He was complaining about, you know, tyre warmer, battery issues. And Sainz himself said if he could get ahead of Max, there was a race win on the cards for him. So at the end, he, like Alonso, he was kind of struggling on the tyres. So that allowed Leclerc to have a go at him into the hairpin. Leclerc was on the outside. Sainz kind of understeered into him and they had a slight touch, forced Leclerc off the track. Leclerc then managed to get him into turn one because Sainz drifted wide once again. But he still wasn't happy with that. He said Sainz went over the limit. Sainz was kind of, I think his attitude has definitely shifted since he's been told he would leave Ferrari because he wasn't holding his hands up and saying, you know, he made a mistake. His comments were along the lines of, oh, if he said that I've gone over the limit, then maybe I have. So a bit of friction there between the Ferrari drivers. I think Sainz is kind of driving for himself in some ways. I think China really epitomised that with some of his comments. But yeah, it was an enjoyable sprint. There was quite a lot of race and action. But yeah, Verstappen was untouchable.
Yeah, I think definitely it was the key battle, wasn't it? It was Alonso trying to desperately cling on to third position. And yeah, I kind of agree with you in terms of the penalty. Obviously, they went side by side through 7 and 8, and it was an unconventional line into turn 9 for Alonso. I think if Sainz isn't there on the outside, Alonso's definitely not making the corner, which is probably why he was adjudged to get the penalty. And I mean, Alonso was penalised anyway because he got a puncture from it and didn't finish. I think obviously with the Sainz and the Leclerc thing, I think there's the old adage that obviously the first person you've got to beat is your teammate. So regardless of sort of obviously the dynamic that's going on at Ferrari and the fact that Sainz's future now lies elsewhere, I think you always want to beat your teammate. And I think also if you talk about the heat of the situation, you know, put yourself in the cockpit. Sainz has just been sort of railroaded at turn 9 by Alonso. They've both lost a position to Perez. Probably the red mist for Sainz comes down then, and he's thinking, I'm not going to let anyone else pass me. And it just so happened it was Leclerc who was trying it. So that's kind of my view on that. And then again, from Leclerc's perspective, again, he wants to beat his teammates. So when he thinks he's being raced hard by Sainz, obviously he's going to say something and sort of take issue with it. But
there is precedent as well for Sainz racing Leclerc quite hard. The one that springs to mind, obviously I saw clips on social media about Monza 2022. I think that's slightly different because it's for the last step of the podium, the Ferrari driver at Monza. But the one that I think really does characterise how much Sainz does have this thing where he wants to beat Leclerc and wants to show that he's better. At Silverstone 2022, last year, 2023, when Sainz was on old tyres at the end and he kind of got overtaken by pretty much everyone, Leclerc was the driver that he raced the hardest, which I thought was quite strange. If anything, if it's a losing battle, I'd imagine you'd let your teammate go and, you know, make sure his progress isn't hampered, but he was really desperate to cling on to that position. And it was the same in the sprint. I do think, regardless of the circumstances around his departure or impending departure, he does have that bee in his bonnet of wanting to, you know, really show that he's as good as Leclerc.
Yeah, that's true. I think, I guess there's a lot of narrative around it, isn't it? It was already sort of being moulded as Leclerc's team, and when Sainz went into Ferrari, people were sort of thinking, like, that's quite a challenge that he set up for himself. So I guess, yeah, he's always wanted to prove something. But then again, yeah, you always want to beat your teammate. Some people. So I think there's maybe in modern F1, there seems to be less of sort of aggressive teammate battles. I think probably the nature of the way races play out, with the way strategy plays out, a lot of time teams split strategy between drivers. A lot of the teams have quite a disparity between the sort of driver talent. So you think Alonso and Stroll at Aston Martin, you're not going to get that issue there. Necessarily, you probably won't get that issue at Williams. You don't necessarily get that issue too much at Red Bull, but you get that issue at Ferrari because they're quite evenly matched. But yeah, an interesting one indeed. But yeah, the sprint obviously was the first piece of action on the Saturday, and then we got after a race on a morning, we then got a qualifying session, which I think felt a bit weird, but it was probably the best way to sort of organise a sprint weekend, to have the qualifying for the Grand Prix on the Saturday afternoon. Hamilton, after finishing second in the sprint, said in the press conference, I need to make some setup tweaks, or I'm going to make some setup tweaks to make sure that we do better later on. Which I think he should have chosen his words a bit more carefully, because whatever he did to the car didn't work, because he was a Q1 exit in qualifying later on. And sort of, I think it was a dry qualifying session instead of the sprint qualifying, which was wet. So the natural order was sort of reset a bit. Verstappen was kind of untouchable on his route to pole. Fernando Alonso, I think for me, was basically one of the top performers of qualifying, Grand Prix qualifying. Let's be clear on that. Third. So, and then the McLarens as well showed great pace. And Ferrari sort of blundered a little bit. So Ferrari, 6th and 7th for McLaren Sainz in qualifying, behind the two McLarens. So it was probably not what we were expecting going into the weekend. I think we were expecting a Ferrari challenge for Red Bull, but it didn't really transpire. And that's because of what was set out in qualifying.
Yeah, Verstappen was imperious in qualifying, as you say. He headed all three sessions and never really looked like being troubled in the dry. And when Red Bull's race pace is typically stronger than their one lap pace, and you have Perez on the front row alongside, and Alonso's Aston Martin in third, you kind of suspected that there's only going to be one winner come race day. But you're going back to one lap efforts, as you say. Ferrari, big shock. We know they've had their one lap struggles so far this season. They struggled with tyre warm up, and it was a cooler weekend in China, so that inevitably impacted them. But still, to be sixth and seventh behind both McLaren's and an Aston Martin, that really set them up for a poor weekend. Russell epitomised where Mercedes are in qualifying, fifth fastest car, which is quite staggering, really, to say the least. I mean, we know qualifiers not been their strong suit with the ground effect cars amid all their struggles, but to be the fifth fastest car, that's not a good look. And I think it really did sum up Hamilton's season in a way. The fact that things looked so promising for him in the sprint, and okay, he wasn't a second place finish in the sprint on merit, but he, as I said, he capitalized on circumstances, the wet weather and qualified, and then the battles behind him allowed him to make a buffer and run his race in clear air. But to go from that to a Q1 exit, and it wasn't even a case of, it was a Q1 exit where he was on the, you know, the brink. He was 18th. And Perez could have joined him. Perez was 15th in Q1. So if Tsunoda hadn't had such a lackluster weekend up to that point, Perez could have been joining Hamilton, which would have, you know, definitely not done his chances any good of keeping that Red Bull seat or, you know, enhancing his comments about wanting to have his future decided now. But yeah, going back to Hamilton, I don't get why he's conducting these experiments still. I mean, I know it's his kind of default thing to go to after every difficult weekend, but Toto Wolff's backed him up on that. Mercedes are in the position that they're in. It's clear that these experiments, whatever they are, they're too extreme, they're not working.
Yeah.
If you've got a driver that's in the groove and is, you know, just delivered a great sprint weekend, why are you trying to compromise arguably your best hope of points in the, you know, the big points scoring race with your star driver? It doesn't add up, and it just threw away another weekend. Not that it means much for Mercedes in the long run, because they're not fighting for a title or wins at this stage. But yeah, if you're going to do experiments, they shouldn't be this extreme to the point where you've got a driver going out in Q1 on actual pace.
Yeah, especially on a week on a sprint weekend, like you've only got 1 hour of practice, you haven't got exactly much to go on. Maybe just stick with what you've got and just make the best of it. It does seem to be very consistent for him this year, where his weekends with Mercedes are consistently inconsistent, and it seems to be because of all these setup tweaks. Like they sort of progress through practice, and they might even have like a peaky practice session where they challenge quite near the top of the timesheets. Then he mentions about making changes at the car for qualifying, and all of a sudden he's nowhere. It's very strange. He seems, I don't know if it's, could you trace it back to potentially the whole sort of thing about when he made these comments about like the Mercedes like design direction, he was ignored, and then they told him he was right. Does he now think he's like an engineer's driver? Which I'd never really put him down to be that kind of driver. I've always sort of put him down to be just sort of a driver who just, once everything's right, he'll just unleash the pace for you. I mean, we saw that through the years when Mercedes had an absolute weapon. Like, he was sort of metronomic in a way, especially with like maintaining tyre life in races and what have you. Just very strange. I think maybe next year when he gets to Ferrari, they should maybe just sort of be like, you know, like, we've got this, just trust us a bit more. But yeah, interesting one for him. But should we talk about how everybody's races went?
Yes, sounds like a good place to start.
I think we should start with Red Bull as well, because probably the easiest one to discuss, because they were very, very good. Probably the strongest they've looked, especially in Verstappen's hands, the strongest the cars looked all year. And he kind of said the same in the press conference. He said it felt, you know, just, it was a great weekend for them. They nailed everything. The balance of the car felt really, really good. And there was a really, really funny sort of question in the post-race press conference where Verstappen was asked sort of like, did you have any troubles and stuff like that? And he was still going, oh, well, yeah, my tear off came, like got stuck in the air intake and I could hear it flapping around. And I just found it quite amusing that he was searching for these like these tiny things. So it was like he really had an easy Sunday afternoon. But I think behind Verstappen, there's a few talking points that are a bit more interesting. But first of all, how do you summarise sort of Verstappen's race? And also Perez, who had a bit more of a struggle, obviously finishing in third place, because Lando Norris was the surprise McLaren filling in a Red Bull sandwich. But how would you sort of summarise Red Bull's race overall?
I think you summarise Verstappen's kind of time of things at the moment with that comment about, you know, his very, very minor issues in the race. And I'm kind of in the process right now of writing a feature for our website where I say it speaks volumes that Verstappen's out there kind of completing like side quests in a way. He's making bets with either Helmut Marko or his engineer. And I think that is kind of something that's keeping him motivated because he's got no competition on the track. Granted, Red Bull haven't got competition and definitely didn't have competition this weekend. But even once Perez has got through past Alonso, he obviously lost out at the start. It's a typical kind of Shanghai circuit characteristic, really, that the driver who qualifies second is pinched on that inside line into turn one. And the nature of the corner means Alonso could sweep round and grab the high ground for the following corners. Perez did, you know, lose up his tyres at that stage. But once he cleared Alonso on lap five, Verstappen was lapping 6 to 7 tenths quicker than his own teammate. And Perez is not a bad driver. Like, we've seen Perez in a midfield car. He was getting raved about. People were saying this guy needs to be in a top car again. And Verstappen is just making him look light work. It's quite sensational. I think, no, regardless of the dominance that Red Bull have, Verstappen's just going up a level every single year. He's still maturing. He's still getting better. And that's a frightening proposition for both his teammate and the rest of the grid. I think Perez is quite unfortunate. Horner said it. Norris and Leclerc are already angling for a one-stop strategy, even without the virtual safety car and then the subsequent two safety cars. Perez is on a two-stop. Horner thinks Perez would have absolutely smashed both of them, and it probably would because of the tyre offset.
Yeah.
But it so happened that a virtual safety car came out. Both Leclerc and Norris pitted, and it kind of meant that their overall time loss in the pits was reduced. And because Red Bull had to make a second pit, well, they didn't have to make a second pit stop, but because of getting to the end with a, you know, good enough tyres on that car, they had to pit at some stage. It was worth taking it while it was a neutralised race condition. That dropped him behind both Norris and Leclerc. And in the turbulence of the Ferrari, he was sliding around a bit. Degradation was quite high anyway. And by the time he cleared Leclerc, Norris was like 5 seconds up the road, and he wasn't going to be able to claw that back, especially when I think a big factor this weekend was if you were running in clear air. As I said, in the sprint, Hamilton was able to keep second because he could run in clear air and manage his tyres. And Norris pointed out the same thing in his battle against Perez. So yeah, quite unfortunate for Perez. I do think he struggled all weekend. He's mentioned that setup-wise, he wasn't really happy. He made compromises for qualifying after he wasn't, you know, satisfied with his setup in the sprint. I don't think he ever had the car underneath him, and especially not in the same way that Max did.
No, 100%. And I think it's probably a combination of a green track surface, isn't it, really? And sort of, and the increased effects of dirty air these days. I think those two things probably combine to make it very tricky to maintain tyre life if you were stuck behind someone. But let's talk about McLaren, because by their own admission and Norris's sort of pessimistic worldview when it comes to Formula One, they didn't think that China was going to be good for them. And I think at the end of last year, people were sort of saying, oh, are they going to be the ones to consistently challenge and be the best of the rest? And sort of Ferrari have assumed that position up until now. But in Shanghai, I mean, Norris recovered from his disappointment of sort of fluffing the start in the sprint, and he looked in sort of fine form, and so did the McLaren in the Grand Prix, and I think a very well-earned second place, which obviously we're talking about you talked about the VSC and the safety car intervention for when Bottas came to a halt. I think that was lap 21 where he ground to a halt and then took a while for them to, you know, trigger the VSC and the safety car, which I guess we can come on to at some point. Initially, it looked like Norris may miss out at that point because the VSC got called just as he passed pit lane, and Leclerc and Alonso dived in. But then I think it was because it became a full safety car, but Norris ended up not losing out. and he actually had quite a good advantage when the racing resumed. And yeah, you just, I think obviously Perez's tyre struggles, but Norris was sort of matching the Red Bull pace in a way, in a very impressive second. And other safety car shenanigans meant that Oscar Piastri couldn't have as good a good end to the race. But yeah, very impressive from Norris and McLaren.
On paper, I think their pessimism was justified, because you look at the Shanghai International Circuit and its characteristics, long radius corners, slow speed hairpins, a long back straight. That goes against everything that's good with McLaren's car right now. So although a bad weekend for them now is, you know, double points finish, we weren't expecting them to be in competition for a podium. And I think even when Norris, you know, and Piastri qualified fourth and fifth, they had both Ferraris, it was still expected that the Ferraris with their superior race pace this season would come through and grab those like last podium spot. But it didn't transpire that way. And it wasn't just a case of, I'm sure we'll get onto this, but it wasn't just a case of Ferrari losing ground at the start. Even when the pack bunched up behind the safety car and went onto hard tyres, Norris had the pace over Leclerc. Leclerc couldn't challenge the McLaren at all. And he said he was losing up to a half second per lap, which is quite seismic, especially against your direct competitor to be losing that much time. But yeah, really mature drive from Norris. It was basically like a win for him, as he said. I know that gets kind of laughed at and it's a bad mentality or whatnot, but when Red Bull and Max are so dominant as a combination, getting second place and splitting the Red Bulls on one of their strongest venues this year, that is a minor victory in a way. And Piastri's race, you can't really read too much into it past the safety car, because he did have significant diffuser damage. I think he finished where he would have done regardless, to be honest. He held off Hamilton, lost out to Alonso, eighth place. I think that's, you know, where he would have finished either way. The only thing for Oscar is the fact that in the first thing, he was nowhere near Norris. I think it comes back to that thing of being in clear air versus dirty air, but degradation-wise, Norris trumped him quite comfortably. And you can't even use the excuse of, oh, it's Piastri's, like, it's basically like a rookie session for Piastri because he's not raced at China before, because none of these drivers have raced the ground effect cars in Shanghai. Norris has only visited Shanghai once, so it's not like he's a specialist in that circuit. He didn't even finish the race in 2019. So yeah, I think that's concerning for Piastri, the fact that he was so far off the pace in race trim, because in qualifying he was actually neck and neck with Norris.
Yeah, it was kind of a quiet race, really, sort of, from Piastri. He didn't really sort of blip up on the radar. I think the same could be said for Mercedes in that race, to be honest. I mean, George Russell finished sixth, but, you know, it was fairly sort of, Mercedes really didn't have a part to play, and they didn't really have a performance to ensure that they could have a part to play in the Grand Prix proceedings. And Ferrari, as you say, they just seem to, you know, be missing a step in China in terms of just pure pace compared to the McLaren of Norris. And yeah, I think they'll be scratching their heads a little bit as to why they've shown quite a lot of promise in the first few rounds of the season, and then China seemed to, I don't know, not reset them, but it was more harking back to their struggles where they were sort of mid-2023. But Fernando Alonso, as ever, seemed to have an eventful race. He can't seem to escape drama or, you know, chaos. So I think we should talk about Aston Martin now. Obviously, he was sort of fighting out of position, because obviously the qualifying performances him and Aston Martin have been doing together have been sort of, you know, outpacing where they are in the sort of the race pecking order. So he knew he was going to fall back. They made an interesting gamble at the safety car to put him on softs, which I think raised a few eyebrows. But I guess if you think you're going to fall down to 7th, 8th, 9th, you might as well have a little gamble. So he sort of tried to fight on the softs, and then he switched to have a short sort of blast on the medium tyres towards the end. I think he dropped down to 12th, I think, when he pitted.
11th or 12th, yeah. He definitely passed Hülkenberg, Hamilton and Piastri in quite quick succession.
Yeah, yeah. He had to pass Ocon and Albon as well, I believe.
Okay, yeah. So yeah, he had quite a few cars to pass, but with that tyre offset and the car advantage, it was kind of easy pickings for Alonso.
Yeah, even with that amazingly close call at the final corner where he dipped a wheel into the gravel and had that very, very sharp opposite lock, which he managed to rescue and then straight away get back onto the tail of Hamilton to then eventually pass him, I think it was into turn six, the right-hander. But yeah, a very fun little punchy race from Alonso, as per. It rewarded him with seventh, which is where he thought he'd end up anyway. So I guess it's pretty clear-cut, isn't it, really? Aston Martin look like they're the fourth fastest team, especially in the hands of the veteran Spaniard. It was an interesting race for his teammate, his, I guess, could you... Harsh, I don't really mean this, but sort of much maligned in a way that we're constantly talking, and not just we as in me and you, but, you know, the sort of motorsports sphere are constantly talking about Lance Stroll's sort of, you know, deficiencies in comparison to Alonso and the reason he's in that Aston Martin team. But there was a slight oversight from him on the first safety car restart, with Verstappen obviously understandably sort of backing up the pack going to the turn 14 hairpin, which has always been the case at Shanghai. You always get those moments where it sort of bunches up at the turn 14 hairpin for a safety car restart. But Stroll wasn't potentially paying as much attention as he should and clattered into the back of Daniel Ricciardo, who, unfortunately for him, he was having probably his best weekend of the year, but his car was basically written off from the incident, and he was very, very angry after the race. And also that, you know, Ricciardo getting rear-ended meant that he shunted into the back of Piastri, which gave him that diffuser damage, which sort of impacted his latter half of the race. So let's talk about that incident. I think my perspective, I mean, Stroll said it was like, you know, it always bunches up, stuff happens, but like he was the only driver to get caught out by it completely. So in my opinion, it was a very serious lack of judgment. So I'm on the Daniel Ricciardo camp. How do you see that incident?
I think anyone that's seen the incident has a portion blame to Lance Stroll, and I think the 10-second penalty was justified. At the end of the day, it wasn't a small tap of Ricciardo's rear. It was a quite sizable hit because Ricciardo went airborne for a moment. So it was clear that he wasn't, as Ricciardo put it, it's clear he wasn't looking ahead because his helmet was turned towards the apex. So there is always that thing, as Mike Rack pointed out, you know, if he'd been caught sleeping at the restart, people would be having a problem with it and having to go in. But that's no excuse, I think, for running into the back of a driver under the safety car. That's just carelessness. And when you're underperforming in pace terms and struggling, giving the critics something like this to talk about, it's not doing you any favours. And I've written an article about it at the end of last season saying, will Aston Martin's, you know, prospects of winning championships always have a ceiling while Lance Stroll's in the team? And I think I've been, you know, vindicated for that article in the early rounds of this season, because when you look at the points total disparity between Alonso and Stroll, and you look at the lap times and the performances and the races, it's night and day. Stroll's opening the door for the bottom five team to score a point and get into Q3, while Alonso's out there battling the Mercedes, the McLarens, the Ferraris. There's no close battle there. And when you look at the direction teams are going in now, you look at Ferrari next year, Hamilton, Leclerc, McLaren, Norris, Piastri, Mercedes, could potentially be Russell and Sainz, you don't know. That's three quite even driver pairings across the board. Aston Martin in that battle, they're going to be, you know, fighting with one hand behind their back. They've got Lance Stroll battling against the likes of RB and Haas and Sauber. So I don't know whether it's a case of, you know, he's just at a really low point mentally, because, you know, you get in a rut, it's very hard to get out. But we know Stroll's been in F1 long enough now to know what his level is. He's not going to magically get better overnight, and he's not at the level Aston Martin want to go. As for Alonso, superb again. He made that comment after qualifying, or I think it was after the race actually, in reference to qualifying, where he said, we're overperforming in qualifying, other teams are underperforming. I think he's kind of missing the point where cars can perform differently between qualifying and the race. We look at Ferrari last year, great on qualifying, so they got the tyre switched on, but then it hit them in the race when degradation came into effect. A non-Ferrari, I am concerned for them slightly. When we do get like this sort of low temperatures, as we did in Shanghai throughout the whole weekend. Miami, they should be okay because it's meant to be boiling hot. But, you know, when the conditions aren't like that, if they can't switch the tyres on, and it's reported that their driver spent half the race trying to switch them on, which is, yeah, quite telling. Because not only are they struggling to get temperature into them, they're also degrading them at the same time. So you've got a double whammy. It's kind of like a Haas 2019 situation where you can't get the tyres switched on, but they're still degrading. So you're not getting, you know, the best of either world in many respects. And Ferrari have got this upgrade package coming to Imola next month, around after Miami. But I can imagine that these developments are in the pipeline prior to this problem, you know, rearing its head. So this could be something that plagues Ferrari's prospects against McLaren, especially in that battle for second in the constructors, up until, you know, mid-season, the latter half of the season, or even next year.
Yeah, and in terms of sort of, if you're talking from like the wider perspective of the sport and fans looking in, wanting a challenger to Red Bull, these are the last things you want to be hearing, is that Ferrari need to eradicate a tyre warm-up so that they're not getting caught up by everybody else, let alone not being able to progress further towards Red Bull, which is a shame. Should we touch on Mercedes quickly? I mean, just a fairly sort of, you know, another afternoon to forget for them. Hamilton struggled massively on his... I mean, he managed to convert 18th on the grid to a ninth place finish in the end, which I suppose is, you know, you can be sort of happy with that result, but it wasn't an enjoyable route for him to get there. He was complaining a lot about the tyres throughout. He never seemed to really be that happy with the car. So, yeah, another difficult time for them. Yeah, it's really... for me, it looks like they're constantly sort of going in the wrong direction, to be honest, with each round. I don't ever see them feeling more positive or seeing like a, you know, any sort of progression. They're either just being stagnant or it's getting slightly worse.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I don't think it's a case of they've gone backwards themselves. The W15's a quicker car than the W14, which is a quicker car than the W13. It's just the fact that with all their problems, they're not making the same progress that McLaren and Ferrari and Aston Martin are making. And the worst thing is for them is they don't really understand their lack of performance each weekend. Post-race, Toto Wolff's bringing up a different problem or diagnosing what the issue is. And it's just different each time. There doesn't seem to be, you know, a grasp of what their fundamental issue is. And if you haven't got a grasp on that, then how are you going to, you know, improve the performance? They've got upgrades coming for Miami, which Wolff has said in the wind tunnel shows a big step. But this overhauled W15 was meant to be, you know, a big step. And it hasn't transpired to be the case. They're just at sixes and sevens, though. Even like their race operations, Hamilton signed on the softs. He said that they went off after one lap. Anyone that watched the whole weekend beforehand would have told you the soft's not a good race tyre. Aston Martin went on to it because Alonso said they didn't have many choices. Yet Mercedes decided to run it at the start. Okay, if he had made up a lot of places and then triggered an undercut load of people, it could have worked. But when the soft was so bad and degrading after one lap, as has always been the case at Shanghai, by the way, you're going to struggle to make a two-stop work from pitting that early anyway. So I don't really get the premise behind their soft tyre choice. And then, yeah, they just don't seem anywhere. I don't really seem any hope for them. You know, this Miami upgrade, you know, might turn around their fortunes, but they're a far cry from the team they used to be. And I'd even argue they're a far cry from the team they were in 2022, because although they started that season badly, by the end of it, there was progress. They won a race, they got a 1-2, they were competing for consistent podiums. Start of 2023, kind of the same story. Once they brought that revised concept, moved away from the zero pod, there was tangible progress there. Double podium at Spain, podium at Canada, podium at Silverstone. You know, there were results, there was something to work from. But I think since the latter part of last year coming into this year, they've just been on a downward trend, and the three teams, you know, fighting behind Red Bull with Mercedes are on an upwards trajectory.
Yeah, it is quite remarkable. You talk about sort of the far cry from the team that used to dominate. I mean, you look at the years when Ferrari were quite a close challenger to Mercedes, so sort of 2017, 2018. It was the shrewd operation of Mercedes that helped, I mean, considerably in their fight against Ferrari and sort of Ferrari's pitfalls in those sort of in those sort of factors. So it is remarkable to see how far they've gone. Maybe it's because James Vowles left. You know, he was the sort of strategy director, wasn't he, at Mercedes? I mean, a lot of people have left Mercedes, haven't they? People that were a part of that sort of successful period. It's not 100% the same team it was in terms of personnel. So maybe that has an effect as well. But yeah, not looking good for them. Normally, I guess at this point in the podcast, we'd be talking about who the sixth best team is, and we'd normally say RB. I think we normally say RB. But they didn't really look to be having that great a weekend. I mean, Tsunoda had a weekend to forget. He just didn't seem to have any pace in the car regardless. And despite Ricciardo having a better weekend and showing a better performance and outperforming his teammate and looking like he could get a points finish, obviously things all ended badly for him because of the Stroll incident. Instead, and also Sauber were looking promising, weren't they, until Valtteri Bottas's engine went pop after 20 or so laps. And their pit stops were looking slightly better as well. So they can't seem to catch a break, although Zhou Guanyu had a fun, sort of punchy second half of the race, you know, battling in the lower positions and soaking up the admiration of the Chinese crowd, which was nice to see. But in terms of picking up the scraps of points in the lower points places, basically 10th normally, as you say earlier, Stroll being the person who's sort of opening up that opportunity for people. It was Haas once again who snuck in there. They seem to be quite a wily, shrewd underdog this year, and Hülkenberg got that final points place. So I guess let's talk about Haas and the rest of the ramblings I just went on. But Haas again, sort of, you know, operating quite well.
Yeah, I feel like we can kind of group RB, Haas and Sauber into one. I think they're the three teams that are kind of leading that fight to capitalize on Lance Stroll's shortcomings more than often than not. As Hülkenberg put it, Haas executed a flawless race, and that's what they have to do to get these 10th place. And I think more than, you know, their ceiling this season is going to be 6th place in the Constructors' Championship. It's only one point, but that one point could be vital. And I think more than that, it's also motivation for the team to see that after such a difficult season last year, where they kind of slipped to being the slowest team, bottom of the championship, they've scored points, I think, 3 times this season in 5 races, including a double points finish in Australia. Yeah. That's a momentum builder. That's something you can build on that keeps, you know, your workforce motivated. And they're doing a great job. Their car's got pace. They've kind of solved their degradation issues. I was very impressed how they bounced back from the sprint, because Hülkenberg had qualified okay in the sprint, sprint qualifying. But then he just dropped backwards through the race. And it was kind of like reminiscent of last year's struggles with tyres. They made changes after the sprint, thanks to the new, you know, format, apart from the regulations being open to the teams. And yeah, they solved those issues, which is an impressive turnaround, and you know, maximized the strategy, dealt with the safety cars well, and got that final point when Stroll rammed into Ricciardo. So Haas are doing all they can. Kevin Magnussen had a bit of a weekend to forget as well as Tsunoda, really, and it's kind of quite telling that those are the two that came together. Magnussen, I am worried for how long his F1 future is going to be. Continuing, I think if Hülkenberg goes to the Sauber team ready for the Audi transition, Haas, you know, they're quite loyal to their drivers, they like experience. I'd imagine it'd be Behrmann comes in to replace Hülkenberg, and they'll keep Magnussen. But Magnussen's not showing he can, you know, take on that mantle of being team leader. And I think Hülkenberg's kind of, you know, a level up from the likes of Romain Grosjean, and kind of really showed what Haas were missing out on when they had a good car like in 2018. So yeah, Magnussen, it was an ambitious lunge. It was kind of a strange incident, because normally two drivers collide at the apex.
It was the exit, wasn't it?
Tsunoda was minding his business. Tsunoda was taking the normal line. Magnussen kind of took like a little stab at the inside, went wide, then tagged Tsunoda's rear on the exit. And that kind of curtailed his race. But Tsunoda had a weekend to forget. He didn't really have any pace. He was a bit baffled. Double Q and exit, not his finest work. Ricciardo had a good weekend. He feels that the chassis change, quite a tongue twister, helped him. He could notice the difference, which You don't know if that's actually tangible or whether it's like a mental thing. You have no idea. I mean, I think a driver, when they've, you know, been underperforming, they get this change that they've wanted and then they perform, they're of course going to say, oh, look at the difference it's made. But yeah, Ricciardo, it was a shame that he didn't actually, I don't think he was on the best strategy. I don't think he'd have got points, but it's a shame we didn't get to see what he could have done and he couldn't get another race distance under his belt. Sauber, it's quite ironic that the one race where they actually, you know, have moderately decent pit stops, I say moderately decent because they're still a far cry from the likes of Red Bull putting in an average of 2 seconds on two double stacks.
Yeah.
But the one race where they actually got it together and didn't give their drivers lengthy pit stops, Bottas, who qualified in the top 10 and looked a good bet for points in race trim in Australia and Suzuka, went out with an engine problem. So yeah, unfortunate for them. It's kind of like, reminds me of last season a bit where Sauber, or when it was Alfa Romeo, they would have these, you know, occasional flashes of pace, but they weren't capitalising on opportunities, which is exactly what Haas did in Shanghai.
Yeah, I think with Haas, I think there was a lot of talk when Gunther Steiner was, you know, let go and Ayo Komatsu came in, and obviously the way sort of Gene Haas said that, I think, you know, with what we've got, we shouldn't be finishing 10th and we should be operating better. And I think that invited a lot of speculation and a lot of ridicule, even where people thought that, like, you know, the way that he operates actually is probably what's holding them back. But I think a lot of credit should go to Ayo Komatsu for whatever he's doing at Haas. It seems to be working. It seems to be a calmer sort of atmosphere, perhaps, maybe at Haas, and they're making the right calls, and you know they're executing well, as you say. And I think when we talk about Sauber, again, there's a lot that needs to change at Sauber for when they become an Audi squad, because as you say, like, engine deficiencies, the pit stops still aren't there. They always seem to fail to capitalise when they have a little flash of pace. These are all the makings of a sort of, you know, a small team that's not operationally efficient or as sound as a big team or a manufacturer team would want to be. So I think we've talked about that at length. But yeah, two more teams, obviously, on the grid. Williams and Alpine. Alpine, things looked a little bit better. I think there were some upgrades on Ocon's car. But still not really anything you'd want to be, you know, writing home about for Alpine. And then Williams, again, just sort of seemed to be not able to make much of a challenge at those, you know, scraps of points like Haas, RB and Sauber can.
Yeah, Alpine, they brought some upgrades this weekend. They accelerated the upgrades. It was a lighter chassis for Ocon. That did the trick, I think, looking at their, you know, double Q1 appearance for the two cars. Ocon finished 11th, and he was only actually, I think, a couple of seconds off Hülkenberg. So it's not like their pace was tragic in this race. Mm. I think they actually, you know, Ocon strung together a decent weekend. And if they can, you know, keep on accelerating these upgrades, cutting down that excess bulk from the A524, they should return to be, you know, in that battle for sixth place. And it's not like they've got much ground to make up. All it takes is, you know, one really attritional race where they're the sixth best team. They've got two really good drivers, Ocon and Gasly, who can score points quite evenly match. And suddenly they're back in that conversation. It's just a case of how quick can they get those upgrades and how quickly can they cut that overweight chassis. Williams, I'm kind of worried for them this season. I mean, I know it's when James Vowell said at the end of 2023 that we don't expect to, you know, make sizable steps in 2024, it was more aimed at the new regulations. I think this is kind of showing what he meant. They overhauled their car concept to, you know, get rid of these characteristics, these negative traits that were existent through previous regulation cycles, to make a more rounded car, a car that's not reliant on, you know, your high speed circuits like Monza, Canada, to get track position and hold up a gaggle of cars. Because in the long run, you're not going to make progress, just keep doing that. There is a ceiling on adopting that type of philosophy. So I think they are they're kind of in a position where they've taken one step back relative to the rest to, you know, make progress down the line. And I don't think we'll see that bear fruit until the next regulation cycle. So it's a case for Williams just waiting out and hoping that it pays dividends at the end. But right now, they don't even look like they're scoring a point.
No. Yeah, I think it's... Yeah, whatever the road is for Williams to get back to being a more consistent team or a, you know, a better performing team, as James Charles has said before, it's a long road, and I think 2024 is proving that, isn't it? Quickly on Alpine, you said obviously the drivers being evenly matched. I think in terms of the struggles that they've had this year and how both drivers have reacted to it, we're also talking about a driver market that's in flux. I would say that Esteban Ocon's response to the challenges at Alpine have been overwhelmingly more positive in terms of the way he's handled it compared to Pierre Gasly. I get the feeling that we're kind of seeing the way Gasly responded to his Red Bull situation. This is purely speculative, but I'm sort of getting that feeling from him again in terms of, like, he doesn't respond to the tough times or adversity, as you say. He doesn't seem to respond very well in those sort of scenarios, whereas I think Ocon has really... You know, he's rallying cries on the radio. He's trying to get as much out of the situation as possible. I think he's really shown... He's a really mature approach from him. So that's just my two cents on Alpine there. I don't know if you agree with my assumption.
I think I can see where you're coming from. I think Ocon's definitely been, you know, the more ringleader in that team and, you know, the motivator, and he's taken on that role. And I think it's because he feels indebted to that team. They got him back on the F1 grid. He has that affiliation with them for a long period. He obviously was a test driver at Renault once upon a time, even before he came to F1. Whereas Gasly kind of, you know, new on the block. I do think Gasly is also doing his part. I have seen a few instances in interviews and team radios where he has been very supportive of the team. He's like, you can get there, we will do it together. But I do, as you say, I think Gasly has that side to him. When times get tough, that frustration does creep in. And that's not going to appeal to, you know, potential suitors in the market, especially when you've got Carlos Sainz's future up in the air. Audi might be on the lookout for a driver. Esteban Ocon, he's looking like a good option.
So we'll leave you to ponder the future of Alpine's drivers Esteban Ocon and Pierre Gasly and their contrasting or maybe similar fortunes at Alpine and beyond. But thank you for joining me, Taylor, once again, and thank you, listeners, for joining us as we discussed the Chinese Grand Prix. Looking ahead in the world of motorsport, we've got MotoGP at Jerez coming up this weekend, IndyCars in Alabama, and Formula E is in Monaco. But make sure you like and subscribe to our podcast on whatever platform you choose to consume it on. And also keep up to date with Motorsport Week and Motorsport Monday. And don't forget to follow us at Motorsport Week on X, formerly known as Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, YouTube, and maybe even LinkedIn. But anyway, for now, goodbye.